وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Since 150 years before, or rather I should say thousands of years before, the Prophet of Islam was born, the grounds were being prepared for his coming. People were being prepared, minds were being prepared by raising the level of their ideas and their thinking and making them hear something over and over again until they get used to it. So when the message actually comes, it's not something strange. People have a hard time accepting strange things, accepting things that are out of the normal. We have a hard time digesting such information. So that's why you see that things are being prepared. Even before the Prophet announces his message and his commission as the Prophet, we see since he's a child, Allah is showing miracles, different sorts of phenomena occurring at the hand of the Prophet, where people, when they see it, when they witness it, they are slowly and slowly getting adapted to recognizing this child as someone special. Allah wanted that to happen so that when the message goes out, when he actually announces Islam, people would look at him as someone who is above all else and above the rest of the people as being holy and sacred. And that's why you see that the caravan that Abu Talib had taken to Sham, on the whole trip to Sham, they had met number of priests and monks, recluses, who witnessed the Prophet, they saw the Prophet, and they identified him and acknowledged him in front of others. And many other great things happened, many other strange things happened throughout the journey. So when the caravan came back, the news of what had happened, the stories of the journey were spread by the 170 people who went with the caravan. They came back to Mecca and they started to speak to their tribes and their people and their family about this young child, the orphan of Abdullah, the orphan of Abdul Muttalib, who has brought us such fortune and such prosperity. And they owed it to him. And they all, in and of themselves, in their hearts, started to get inclined towards the Prophet as being someone who is holy. And everyone rejoiced. The Meccans, they all had a big party. Everyone came out. They all were joyful. Everyone came out to meet the caravan, except for one person. And that one person who refused to come out and who refused to hear anything that has to do with the Prophet, not because of he's a prophet, but because the fact that he's from Bani Hashim, was Abu Jahl. He's the only one who did not come out, refused to come out, stayed home. But then it went by, and hence after that, Abu Talib now started giving more responsibilities to the Prophet. I mentioned last week how he went through different trade caravans to different places in Yemen, in Sham again, and other places, even, for example, I told you, like Dubai. Well, that happened, and so as things were happening, certain things that identify him and that makes him particular, makes him special, I want to mention today. Certain things that happened, and I think this really helps us, you and me, to have a very good understanding of what kind of a person was the prophet. And this is even before he declared his prophethood or commissioned his prophethood. And we know after that. But before that, what sort of a person was he? What decisions would he make? I think this goes a long way to show that. So inshallah, this is what we want to understand. The whole idea of knowing these speeches and hearing it is to understand the prophet. Let me make one point before I explain further. Send aloud salawats.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
There's an ayat in the Quran that I read for you, and that says, لَكَدْ كَانَ لَكُمْ فِي رَسُولِ اللَّهِ أُسْوَةٌ حَسَنًا. He said, Allah is saying that the Prophet is the best example for you. Now obviously by the Prophet we also mean the Imams. We also mean Ahlul Bayt. All of them are the best example for us. Now Allah sent the ayat, sent the verse regarding the Prophet. But my friends, my brothers and sisters, hear this and hear this very well. Of all the masumeen, if you look at the history of Imam Ali, if you look at the history of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein and all the other Imams that came after that, if you look at their history and if you look at the circumstances they lived in, you will understand and you will see that truly, of all the masumeen, the one example that actually fits into our life, meaning your life and my life, the one example that actually fits into our circumstances and our situation is the example of the Prophet. Imam Ali is a great example. Imam Hussein is a great example. Imam Hassan is a great example. But there's one technical problem by which our situation is different than theirs. And hence their example doesn't totally fit in our life. And that is, my friends, that we find ourselves in the same situation, in the same environment, in the same circumstance that the Prophet lived his life. None of the Imams, and Imam Ali did for a certain time, but after that, none of the Imams ever lived in a non-Muslim country or environment. The only one who actually lived in a non-Muslim environment is the Prophet. He's the one who lived amongst non-Muslims, kuffar, people who don't believe in God. He's the only one. The rest of the Imams lived in a Muslim environment. And it wasn't the best, but whatever it was a Muslim environment. In other words, in a Muslim environment, the difference is, for example, small things, but really it goes a long way. For example, in a Muslim environment, you go to a Muslim country, you can walk into any restaurant and eat there. Right? In a non-Muslim environment, you got to find out whether this is halal or not. And that's the reason, for example, online websites like Zabiha.com only work in a non-Muslim environment. You can't have Zabiha.com in Pakistan. Like, what's this for? Why? Because they're all Muslims there. All the restaurants and the meat that comes is halal. People are slaughtering them according to Islamic law and the Sharia. It's a Muslim society. So when you go to a Muslim country, you see it's different. In a non-Muslim country, it's different. Here, the issues are different. What we go through is different. What we face is different. How we have to deal with these people is also different than how you would deal with Muslims in a Muslim society. And that's the reason why the example of the Prophet is so ideal for us. So made for us. Because the Prophet lived his life most of his life in a non-Muslim environment where people are not Muslims, they don't even believe in God, or if they do, it is a false God, it is idol worship, and all kinds of ignorance. We see that there. And we see the same ignorances in the society that we are living in. And hence, this is the reason why the example of the Prophet becomes much more relevant in our lives. And that's why we are learning it, in order to see what is our behavior and what is our interaction and how do we deal with the people and the situations that we find ourselves in. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. Alright, my friends, certain incidents happened, two of them in particular that I'll mention today. And those incidents were like this. In the Arab world, some things were respected, some things were honored, time honored, and regarded as respectable, regarded as honored. For example, the Kaaba was one of them. Kaaba had found a place in the Arab society where they respected it, where they honored it. In other words, you know, you will not do anything wrong, you will not sin, you will not do anything evil, or you will not commit a crime near the Kaaba. If you want to swear, if you want to take an oath, you want to do something sacred and holy, you would go to the Kaaba. Now, they're not Muslims, they don't believe in Allah, they don't believe in these things, but still, they regarded the Kaaba as holy, as respectable. That's one of the things. And certain things that they regarded were certain months of the year. Certain months of the year they regarded as holy and sacred. And they called it Ashhur al-Haram, meaning months that are, it's forbidden for you to fight and to start a war. So whatever wars they had would stop in those months. They would not start a war in that month. Right? And amongst them is Zilqadah and Zilhajjah. Now, because there's no war starting, because it was sacred, so that's why the Arabs, in their customs, and the traditions had made certain time, because it's off from war and other things, so they took this time. They took this time, they took these months, Zilqadah, and they had a big party. Yes. For 40 days they partied every year. Now, how did this go about? Let me explain that to you. We send aloud salawats. They would have a carnival. A carnival in a place called Ukaz. This carnival will start every year from the 1st of Zilqadah, and it will last till the 20th of Zilqadah. And in this carnival, all the tribes would come. They would bring whatever they have made or whatever they have, you know, made up in terms of entertainment, in terms of intrigue, in terms of fun and excitement. Obviously, it's a non-Muslim society, so there's a lot of drinking and revelry that's going on, right? So it's like a big, huge bash. Everyone comes there, they have lots of fun over there. And while they're fun, there's also, for example, because they're together, they would have the important meetings at that time. It's like business over entertainment. They would go and have meetings, the elders would sit down and they would discuss things. This is a fair of Ukaz. Now, once that fair is done, you know, Ukaz, then everyone moves to another fair, which is called Majinnah. The carnival of Majinnah. It starts on the 21st of Zilqad until the ending of Zilqad. 10 days. And they go there. Now, Ukaz is 3 nights travel from Makkah. Jinnah is two nights travel. So when this fair is done, everyone packs up, moves the party to Majinna, right? And they all go there. And then from there, you will see that after the 10 days there, on the first of Zilhajj, they will now move to another place, which is one night's travel from Makkah, which is known as Dhul Majaz. Dhul Majaz, they would go there and they will have a party there from the first of Zilhajj to the 8th of Zilhajj. It will be a carnival, like a state fair. Everyone comes there from all over the place, makes their best foods, you know, people enjoy each other's foods, they enjoy each other's company, and you know, the party is going on. So that will happen till the 8th of Zilhajj, and at the 8th of Zilhajj, they will all go for Hajj. They will all move and they'll go to Arafat for Hajj. And this was their life. This was the way they used to do things. This was a yearly thing that happens in the Arab world. Now, I mentioned this obviously because later on in the seerah of the Prophet, in the history of the Prophet, this is going to come a lot. And you will see this. As the Prophet now declares his prophethood, you will see how these places and these people are going to play a big part in where the Prophet spent his time. So that inshallah will come later. Right now, the reason I mention this is because in that fair of Ukaz, the carnival that's going on, a person by the name of Noman from the tribe of Kinana, in the clan of Kinana, he hired a person by the name of Urwa to tend to his livestock, you know, his camels, to look after them. You know, because in those days, the rides that you had were camels or horses. Nowadays we have cars. So, for example, when you have lots of cars, then you will hire someone to look after your cars, parking lot, right? So he hired a person by the name of Urwa to look after his camels. So now, as Urwa was looking after his camel, his opposing tribe by the name of Bani Qais. Now these names, inshallah, you know, obviously you're not going to remember these names, but I just get the idea. Right? Bani Qais, this saw this person, Urwa, tending to the camels of Nu'man, who's from their opposing tribe. So they come to him and they pick on him and end up killing him. They just kill him in cold blood. Yes, in broad daylight. Just kill him and go away. So now Noman feels responsibility because this is his employee, his worker. Although in those days you didn't have, you know, for example, unemployment or something like that. You know, if a person dies at work, you know, you're not responsible for those in those days. No lawsuits or anything. But he felt responsible. He said, you know what? I hired him to work and I feel responsible that I need to now go and get justice for him. So he goes to the tribe of Qais, Bani Qais, and he starts arguing with them. And the argument he gives them, the argument he brings forward to them is very simple. He says, listen, you killed this guy in cold blood, in broad daylight, you killed him, so now either give over the killer to us or give the blood money that you owe. Now there are two things, and it's logical. You killed him, so now you owe blood money. Either give that or you give that person to us so we can take revenge. Bani Qais decided not to do anything. They said, you know what? He's not responsible because we are just better than you are. So we deserve to live and you don't. So you can do whatever you want. Sue me. You know, just told him off. Just like that. Just told him off just like that. And so Noman is like, what? I mean, you know, so now he goes back to his tribe, Bani Kinana, and he tells them what happens and his tribe agrees with him. He says, you are right. You are on the truth and you deserve justice. So, on the other hand, Bani Qais has already decided that we, just the fact that he pointed a finger at us, shows that we are disrespected. And they stood up on ignorance, and lo and behold, a war started between the two tribes. They started fighting. They went to war with each other. Now, my friends, this was one of the sacred months, Zilqada. And this war is happening in a sacred month that is obviously in the Arab world very distasteful and disgusting. You don't start wars here. It's like an unwritten rule in the Arab society that you don't start wars. So when this war is started between the two sides and these two people, so Banu Hashim, they inquired, what's going on here? Right? Especially Abu Talib, who's the chief of Makkah. He comes forward and says, what's going on? Why did you start a war for? What's this war? So Noman and his tribe explain to Abu Talib and Bani Hashim as to what happened. Bani Hashim agrees with his story. They agree with the fact that he is right and that his plead to the opposite tribe is justified. That either they give over the killer or the blood money. So obviously Banu Qais don't want to budge. So Bani Hashim end up siding with this tribe and they take part in the war. This war is called Fijar. Fijar means sin. You know, like for example, Fajir. Fajir is someone who's a sinner, right? Fajara means to sin. And the reason it was called a sin is because the war was started in a sacred month. And it's a sinful war. Now the war is started, Banu Hashim is taking place in that war. And the other tribes are on the other side, this tribe is on this side, the war is taking place. Now let me explain to you how wars work in the Arab world, if you send a salawat. My friends, wars in the Arab world are not like other places in the world. Yes. I mean, there are rules that are already decided for war. For example, wars would not last like without end. Every time anyone wants to go to war, right, it's a time to decide, okay, we'll fight for 1 week and then we'll take a break. You know? Right? That's the way wars were, you know, because we have to tend to our animals, our farms, our business and all that. I mean, if you just keep on whining, you know, we'll all die hungry, right? So what's the use of that war? So, you know, I mean, there actually used to be a timeout in war, you know? Okay, everyone, timeout, you know, stop the war, you know? We'll meet back in 4 months and then we'll start fighting. Right? That's how wars were in those days. So what would happen is that a war would start and then after, for example, a few months of witches and hostile fighting, they will stop and they'll go back to their tribes, live their life, and next year again they'll come back and say, alright, it's time for war again, come on guys, you know, and they'll call each other, okay, you know, and they'll start the same place. Like for example, you know, you're playing a chess game or something, you know, with someone, and you're like, okay, you know what, that's enough, we'll meet next week and start where we left off, you know. So then everyone would come and say, okay, your horse was that side, my horse was here, okay, ready, let's go. I mean, yes, it sounds ridiculous, maybe it is ridiculous, but that's the way the wars were in those days. That's how they used to fight. So now what happened is that a war would have different segments, different parts to it. You know, for example, X war part 1, X war part 2, like that, you know. It's like a sequel coming, you know. So now what happened is that this war had 4 sequels to it. Right, one sequel came, fighting ensued, and then stopped, and then they went back, and then another, they came back again, and they fought again, and they went back, and third time, the fourth time that it happened, the fourth part of the war of Fajr was that battle, that war that the Prophet was involved in. He wasn't in Makkah in the first 3 parts, but the fourth war, the fourth part of this battle of Fajr is where the Prophet himself took part in that battle. Now obviously he did not do any fighting. He did not fight. He himself has said that I, even though I took part in that war, but I never raised a sword, never threw an arrow. The job that the Prophet was doing was tending to his uncles. His uncles were there, he would fetch the arrows for them and give it to them, and that's it. He did not want to take part in the war, because the wars that used to happen in Jahiliyyah and everywhere else are indiscriminate war where you just attack people without seeing who's right and wrong. There's no rules, there's no idea of what should stop, what's the goal, nothing. It just go on. It's ignorance. So this war, the Prophet was in Makkah, he came there, saw them fighting this war and this and that. This is the fourth, war of the same war, the fourth segment of the same war. So now what happened is that the Prophet went to his uncle, his oldest uncle, Zubair. He went to him and said, I have an idea. He wasn't declared as a prophet yet. So there's no seniority, he's just a normal person, right? So he goes up to his uncle, Zubair, and he tells him that, uncle, I have an idea, right? And he says, what is that? He says, instead of fighting, why can't we talk to them and get it over with? Zubair looks at him and says, yeah, let's do that. Makes sense, right? Come on. Let's do that. They're like, oh, okay. The young lad over here says no fighting, we can talk. And they're like, talk? Yeah, talk. They're like, yeah, it might work. After four wars, they finally get the idea of talking. So now they went, Zubair goes to the other side, he said, hey guys, let's talk it out, get it over with. The other side is like, okay, sure. And they talk it out, come to an agreement and stop the war. Right? Now, this was one incident that happened that, where you see this. The Prophet actually took part in the war. He was there. Then he helped to stop it, through negotiation, through talking, and made peace. This is one incident that happened. It was big in those days. It was like rumored and this and that. There's injustice that happened, right? And Bani Hashim, they believed in God. They believe in the deen of Ibrahim. They would not do wrong things. The Prophet obviously is the Prophet of Allah. He will not do anything wrong. But the fact is that he did take part in the war. Just for him taking part in the war means that he condones it. He condoned it. And the reason he condoned it is because this war was actually being fought for some injustice that had happened. There was an injustice that happened. And when that injustice happened, the Prophet went so far as to take part in that fight in order that this injustice is undone. This is one incident that happened. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala ali Muhammad. And right after this incident happened, there's another incident that happened. Because this is leading somewhere, and I want you to pay attention to where this is leading. It is crucial in the seerah, in the history of the Prophet. Another incident happened right after this is that a Yemeni trader from the tribe of Banu Zubayd, a Zubaydi guy, he came to Makkah from Yemen to trade his stuff. One of the well-off, sons of chiefs of Makkah decided to go and buy from him. He bought his whole lot. Whatever he bought it from him. He says, give it. So he took it home. And so Yemeni guy is happy that, alhamdulillah, I sold all my stuff in one day. So he's happy. He made business, he trade, and everything is done. Now he can go back to his family, right? Well, so what happened is that when he took the stuff to his home, now the Yemeni guy went to him, Aas, and he asked him for the money. And Aas said, what money? The money that you owe me. You bought all this stuff from me. He says, I don't owe you anything. I don't owe you anything. So he refused to pay him. Now obviously now the Yemeni guy, he's just a normal trader. And this is his life's work, right? This is what they do. So he comes over there and he sees that and he's like, he pleads with him, but there's no answer. So now in those days, what you used to do is that you would go to the other elders, the other chiefs of Makkah. You would go to them and you would plead with them, hey listen, this is what happened. I came to Makkah and look at this. This injustice has happened to me. He took my stuff, he's not giving back my money. Now the other chiefs who were there, the other elders of Makkah, they know us. Us is one of them. He says, well, we're not going to side with you against one of our own. Right? So his pleading fell on deaf ears. No one wanted to help him. Everyone turned their back on him. And this guy has no place to go. He has no place to go. What's he going to do? So he did what everyone in trouble, extreme trouble, does in Makkah. He went to the mountain of Abu Qubais. Yes. Abu Qubais. Those who have been for Hajj or Umrah would know where the mountain of Abu Qubais is. Abu Qubais is a mountain that is right next to the Haram, next to the Kaaba. It is recognized nowadays by the fact that on top of the mountain they have built the palace for the king. Right? Yes. The palace for the king is on top of the mountain of Abu Qubais. If you see that, right? The mountain, right? And obviously the palace was built and then the Haram was renovated. When the Haram was renovated, the king from his bedroom could not see the Kaaba because one of the pillars was coming in the way. So he had it knocked down so he can see the Kaaba. Right? So that's why you'll notice that in the Haram of Makkah, there are two pillars everywhere except for in front of his bedroom. Now there's one pillar. Right? Because one pillar was knocked down because he had to see the Kaaba, you know, and it's obstructing his view. Right? Lowered his property value. Now this Abu Qubais, this mountain of Abu Qubais, right, is a very historical mountain. This was the mountain on which Prophet Ibrahim had gone on top of when Allah asked him to call the people for Hajj. He went on top of this mountain and raised his voice to call the people for Hajj. This is the mountain, right? And now, in those days, in the days of the Arabs, right? I want you to understand this very well, right? Because the Arabs, even though they are illiterate, even though that they're ignorant, but in some things they were smart, right? One of the things they were smart in is the fact that, hey, listen, they had decided some years ago that what if we are attacked? After Abraha attacked them, they said, well, Abraha at least announced that he's attacking us and we had the time to move out. But what if someone attacks us all of a sudden? Ambushes Makkah. What should we do then? So after that, they had made a secret code, like a 911 number you would dial. They said that anyone who has any important information that would affect the lives of the people of Makkah, they had made a secret code that he would go on top of the mountain of Abu Qubais and would announce and would call out and say, Wa Sabaha. Wa Sabaha. This was a secret code that all the Meccans knew that if anyone calls this out, it means that there's something of an emergency happening. It was an emergency call for them. So anyone who would announce that, everyone will come rushing out. Everyone would come rushing out to hear what the news is and to see what the emergency is. Right? It's like an emergency call. Right? But this is like an emergency for the people. So this is the reason, my friends, this code was made. It was a natural call that everyone would come out to. Everyone would listen to, and they would come out and hear further instructions. And this is the reason why you see, when the Prophet made his first announcement of Islam, he went on top of the mountain of Abu Qubais, and he made the emergency call and said, Wa Sabaha. When he said wa sabaha, everyone came out because that was something that was established in the city. And he used that to call the people out. And then he announced that famous statement that if there was an army behind this mountain, would you believe me? And they all said yes, and then so on happened. That history happened, and you know that history. That happened because it was an emergency code in that city where everyone would come out, and anyone who has to say something that will affect the lives of the people in Makkah, he should go up there and make this call so that everyone knows that this is an emergency. This is why, you see, he went there. So now as this person climbed that mountain and he called out to the people, then everyone came out. Man, everyone, then he started to say that I have been done injustice with, I am a foreigner here, I am from Yemen here, and this is what I have been done with. He took my stuff and he's not returning it, nor is he giving the money for it. My stuff has been stolen from me, and he goes on crying. Now, obviously what happened is that the elders who came out there, the chiefs who came out to see what's going on, when they saw him, they said, oh, it's that guy, you know, and they just walked away. You know, you can cry as much as you want. But when Bani Hashim came out, they actually were interested. He said, what's going on? What happened with you? Now, Bani Hashim did not know of this. They did not hear of us. Abu Talib did not hear of this. The reason is because the chiefs of Makkah, the elders of Makkah, used to sit around the Kaaba. And they would, you know, open shop there. Bani Hashim were not in the mood of opening shop like them. If anyone wanted anything, they would come to the neighborhood of Bani Hashim. That was a little bit away from the Kaaba. So these chiefs were there, and so this person never went to Bani Hashim. He doesn't know who's who here. All he knows is that I'm a stranger and I've been robbed. So he goes then, and Abu Talib and Zubair, right? Zubair, the eldest of the brothers, asks him, what's going on? What happened? And so he tells his story to Zubair and the other people of Bani Hashim. Now Zubair is really upset. The oldest uncle, and he's highly respected in Makkah. He's really upset at what happened. He tells the other people, he says, this is wrong that has happened here. What has happened to him is wrong, and this is happening in Makkah. Makkah obviously is a sacred place. This is happening in Makkah. We cannot allow this to happen. So he gathered some people, and he went to the house of As, the person who stole from him. And then he forced him to give back his stuff so that that person received the stuff. He said, now you can go and do your things. But after they did that, after they made it happen, they got into a serious discussion. All of them who were there, they got into a serious discussion. They said, how can this happen here? You know, like for example, if in Al-Wilay, you see someone comes over here and just robs someone, you know, and takes his wallet, you know, this and that, you know, in some places, in some masjids, right, they are so aggressive in fundraising, it's like hog tying your members and taking everything out from them, right? So what happened is that you come over here and see them robbed like that, something like that, right? You'll be like, what? In this place, this happened to you, you see, you'll feel that sentiment of trying to do justice and making sure that, you know, injustice doesn't happen here. Right? This is how you feel. This is how Zubair, Bani Hashim and others felt when this happened. And they said, this is happening here. And this person had the guts to go on the mountain and speak of it. How many others have been robbed and they have no outlet to say anything to? No outlet to say anything. They can't say anything. They just walk away from here, saddened that we went to Makkah and we got robbed. This is how it happens in Makkah. There are thieves over there. You see, this is what made them upset. And so this serious discussion now changed this venue to the house of one person called Abdullah. They went into his house and they all, you know, others came and they were discussing this. They said, we need to stop this. We cannot let injustice happen here like this. And so, at that minute, they all made a pact. They made an agreement. And they swore by the agreement to stand by that agreement. And that agreement was known as Halful Fudul. Halful Fudul, the pact and the agreement that was made to protect the rights of those who have been robbed. It says that يُرَدُّ الْفُضُولُ إِلَىٰ أَهْلِهَا, returning the rights to the people who deserve that right. So anyone in Makkah, anyone who is robbed and done injustice to, they all swore that they will be with each other, make this pact, make this organization by which we are going to stand up for the right of the victim and the right of the oppressed. And they all signed it. They all signed it. They signed an agreement to protect the right of those who are oppressed, the oppressed people. One of the signers on that agreement was the Messenger of Allah. Rasulullah actually signed that agreement. Now, Rasulullah is a prophet. Everything he does from the beginning to the ending is according to Allah's direction. He signed that, and then later on, he prided himself on being a part, a signatory on that agreement. And he used to say, after declaring prophethood, that if that agreement and if that pact was brought before me again and again, I will sign it again and again. He said, if there's anything that I loved and was proud of from the days of Jahiliyyah, it was this agreement that was made in order to protect the rights of the oppressors, of oppressed. My friends, Rasulullah, from here we understand what kind of a person was he. Here's where we understand. When you look at this and you see him being involved. Now these people that he's protecting are not Muslims. These people whose rights that he is looking after are not Muslims. In fact, they would be his most vehement enemies. They would be the people who would, you know, go against him and oppose him in the most horrific way. But you see that if they also are oppressed, if they also are victimized by injustice, Rasulullah is saying that my way is to stand up for their rights and to fight for their rights and to make sure that I give the right of those who are oppressed back to them from the oppressors. My friends, this is the path that Rasulullah in his history is teaching us. How is it possible that someone who believes in the Prophet, who recites the testimony of the Prophet, can sit down over here and sees injustice happening and oppressors oppressing in front of his eyes, sees it happening and does not do anything to be a part of something that will bring back the right of the oppressed to them? How is it possible? How can we sit here and know that someone is raising a flag for the oppressed and we don't want to take part in it? Really, if the Prophet was with us, do you think he would look at us and smile? Or he would just brush us off, ignore us and walk away? My friends, maybe from here we can understand the importance of Yawm al-Quds. Day of Quds is really that Halful Fudul that Rasulullah has signed. Are you ready and willing to do what he did and feel proud of it? That Rasulullah, I stand with the victimized, I stand with the oppressed against the oppressors.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
This is, my friends, where we learn who the Prophet is in a non-Muslim society. No Muslim is there. No Muslim's right is being taken at that time. Nothing. Non-Muslims. If you see a non-Muslim's right being taken, then it is our job as a Muslim and a follower of the Prophet to stand up for his right. To stand up for his right and raise our voice for it. It is our duty. It is our commitment to the Prophet. And inshallah, this is why when we see any organization, any flag that is being raised to help the victims, to help the oppressed, then we feel obligated, Ya Rasulullah, being your disciple and learning from your life, that we must also stand up for those who are oppressed. This is, my friends, something that when we look at it, we need to talk to ourselves alone with our Prophet. And if you haven't done that in your life, you should start doing it. You should start talking to the Prophet and the Imam alone. Because you know what? Imam is more impatient in wanting to talk to you. When you talk to him, right? These are the things that are going to be discussed. That are you following our way, our path? And we should tell them, and tell the Prophet, and tell the Imam, yes, I'm following your path. And this is the path that Rasulullah has shown in his life, in his young life. At this age, Rasulullah was 20 years old. 20 years when he signed this path. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the tawfiq and the blessing to be on the right path. Wisdom to understand his guidance. Hasten his reappearance of our Imam. Make us his helper when he comes. وَآخِرُ الدَّعْوَانَ أَنِ الْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ